content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, my name is Maureen McDonald. From the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the October 2019 Walter Magazine. We begin in the Locals Department with A Culture of Curiosity. Dr. Paulette Dillard preserves Shaw University's legacy with an eye toward the future, by Alina Evan. You might expect greatness from anyone who asked for a proper fountain pen for her 13th birthday. I just wanted to practice my signature, says Dr. Paulette Dillard, and it's a good thing she did, because as Shaw University's president, Dillard signs on the dotted line many times a day. Hailing from Mount Airy, North Carolina, Dillard was the first in her family to earn a college degree. She attended segregated schools until her senior year, when she was bused to a new school through forced integration. In a class of 200, Dillard was one of six black students. Despite the change, she thrived. A dedicated and affable student who drove a baby blue Mustang, she made friends easily, was an honor student, and held a spot in her school's royal court. It was in high school that Dillard sharpened her confidence, which is one reason she wants to help students today learn to identify their strengths. I want to teach kids how to learn and to foster a sense of adventure and discovery, says Dillard. That aligns with the university's mission to advance knowledge, facilitate student learning and achievement, enhance the spiritual and ethical values of its students, and transform a diverse community of learners into future global leaders. As president, Dillard cultivates the same love of learning that fueled her own journey. At its core, Shaw University is positioned to make a difference, says Dillard. A long-standing beacon of the community, Shaw University was founded in 1865, born out of inequalities in education at the time. It's one of the oldest historically black colleges and universities in the country. Its former Leonard School of Medicine was the first four-year medical school for African Americans in the country. Today, Shaw offers majors in 34 disciplines, an adult degree program at sites across the state, plus a master's through its divinity school. The university attracts most of its students from North Carolina and feeders in the Mid-Atlantic, but Dillard notes a recent, quote, spate of students from as far away as California, where there's only one HBCU. I want the students of Shaw University to have the freedom to imagine, says Dillard, whose philosophy is centered on creativity and exploration. She believes in marrying the best aspects of the scientific method with the simple notion of curiosity. She believes in integrating all aspects of learning to curate lifelong that can compete in any environment. Success takes many forms, she says. It's a matter of learning versus teaching skills. Dillard's dream project is to fund an interdisciplinary institute for digital storytelling that integrates film, computer science, and more. This will preserve Shaw's legacy and make its voices come to life. Dillard is a self-described wise and hows kind of person, a trained medical technologist certified by the American Society of Clinical Pathology, who enjoyed a 25-year career in medical testing before shifting to teaching. Her trajectory at Shaw began as a biology teacher in 2012. Soon she became department head, then dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, vice president of academic affairs, and now president. She served as interim president starting in July 2017 and was appointed the 18th president of the university in September 2018. She went through the full formal ceremony of investiture in April. The president's office sits atop the iconic brick building on campus. It was built in 1873 as the first women's dormitory at any school in the country. Here, Dillard recounted the rich history of Shaw and its legacy. She said Shaw University is considered the mother of four other HBCUs in North Carolina. The founding presidents of North Carolina Central University, Elizabeth City State University, and Fayetteville State University were all Shaw alum, and NCA&T State University was established on Shaw's campus. Prominent physician Dr. Manasseh Thomas Pope was educated at Shaw in 1885. His home is one of the few standing structures from Raleigh's Fourth Ward and the only African-American house museum in the state. The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee was born on Shaw's campus in 1960. Poignant for me, one of SNCC's founders, Julian Bond, was my professor of the history of the civil rights movement at the University of Virginia. The office looks out over the burgeoning Raleigh skyline, and as the sound of the midday bustle floated through the windows, Dillard noted Shaw's importance, not just as a university, but as part of a growing city. Dillard is an active participant in the neighborhood at large, who attends citizen advisory council meetings, hosts community forums, and supports neighborhood initiatives to preserve the spirit of Southeast Raleigh. My responsibility and influence extend beyond the green quad and brick buildings of campus, she says. Part of my role is to remind the community that Shaw belongs to it as well as to the students entrusted to my care. Invest in Shaw because we have a lot to contribute. Our history proves that. You'll find Dillard in her office most days with a special Mont Blanc fountain pen encrusted with a garnet, Shaw University's signature color, given to her by the late Reverend Dr. Haywood Gray of the General Baptist State Convention. Gray was scheduled to lead the prayer at her inauguration, but sadly passed away just a week before. That pen serves as a reminder of both what she had dreamed of as a girl and the promise she holds for students today, students just a few years older than she was when she got her first proper fountain pen. And in a second Locals feature, we have Sail Away by Miranda Evan. At 103, local sailor recalls his journeys around the world. When Marvin Creamer was 5 years old, his father had him stand at the southwest corner of their barn in Vineland, New Jersey. Note, he told him, the place on the horizon where the sun sets. Day after day, Creamer watched to see if the sun set in the same place. Over time, he realized, the sun disappeared in different spots on the horizon with the changing seasons. I regret never asking him why he had us watching sunsets, says Creamer, who's now 103 and living in North Raleigh. But that practice gave him one of the tools he'd need to achieve a lifelong dream, to sail around the world without navigational equipment. Creamer's fascination with sailboats started at a young age, too. In 1921, the same time he'd watched the sunset, his father attempted to build a toy boat out of white pine board and home-sewn muslin. By model sailboat standards, it was crude, he says, but I thought it was the most beautiful thing on earth. Creamer and his older brother took to building real sailboats, teaching themselves how to sail and sailing out on the lake by their house. He knew at a young age that he wanted to be a sailor. His instincts came in part from his education. Creamer studied geography, later teaching the subject at Glassboro University, now Rowan University, before retiring in 1977. While he says he was never properly taught how to sail, Creamer took classes that would later help him: meteorology, oceanography, and zoology. Between his time teaching and growing a family of his own, he still made time for his hobby, sailing around and across the Atlantic. And although he never received formal lessons, Creamer always pushed boundaries while on the water. On his first trip, without navigational tools, not a watch, map, or a compass, Creamer departed from Ireland in 1978 with his then 19-year-old son, Kurt Creamer. My favorite memory was being able to talk with my dad about many things that we never seemed to have time for before, says Kurt Creamer. The pair, along with a neighbor in New Jersey, traveled 3,400 miles across the Atlantic. When they arrived back at the New Jersey port, a reporter from the New York Times asked Creamer if he'd ever thought about sailing around the world instead of just across the Atlantic. I couldn't lie, he said, so I told her that I'd always wanted to do a circumnavigation. I'd wondered whether it was possible. So a few years later, he tried it. From December 1982 to May 1984, Creamer, along with a crew of friends, guided his 36-foot sailboat, the Globe Star, around the world without any navigational instruments. The course was determined solely by the surrounding nature, positions of the stars, waves, the color of the water, the passage of the sun, and flights of migrating birds. The crew began their trip in Cape May, New Jersey, sailing to their first stop in Cape Town, South Africa. They sailed out at dusk on the first night of winter. The sky was gray, covered in clouds. It was freezing and the air was still, he says. You wouldn't think, but it was perfect. For 17 months, Creamer and his fluctuating crew sailed to South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, the Falklands, and through Drake's Passage, the deadliest part of the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans between Antarctica and South America. And the final leg of their journey was sailing back home to New Jersey, completing the trip of a lifetime. Following his sailing career, Creamer and his wife, Blanche, moved to the North Carolina coast at Pine Knoll Shores to a quiet home on the canal, with enough room for a sailboat, of course. Kurt Creamer says he and his dad would go clamming at Core Sound, a few miles north of Pine Knoll Shores. Although even in his 80s, he typically raked more clams than me, says Kurt. Kurt says that his dad joined him at age 95 with his two nephews on a sail from Maine to North Carolina. It was simply remarkable to me that he still enjoyed the rigors of sailing at that age. Kurt says he still sails on his cruising sailboat and small catamaran, while his dad retired his sea legs a few years ago. Although Creamer's sailing was primarily a solitary pursuit, it wouldn't have been possible without his wife's support. He reflects on his 59 years with his wife, Blanche, who passed away in 2005. She was never opposed to him sailing until he planned to sail around the world, leaving him absent for a year and a half. Creamer recalls her saying, "Why would I want you going off for a year and a half? You're the best friend I ever had." Despite her misgivings, she helped him prepare for the trip and looked forward to long-distance phone calls when he would find a phone in port. In 2018, Creamer moved to Raleigh to be closer to his son and one of his two daughters. In his apartment at Atria Oak Ridge, he's surrounded by model sailboats and miniature flags of the places he sailed to. He tells stories of his worldly travels to any neighbor with an open ear, remembering every detail, down to specific dates and names of friends that accompanied him while sailing. Creamer says his life is filled with oddities, one of them being his age. Before reaching the century mark, his physician told him he might make it to 100. Now 103, Creamer says he just keeps waking up every day. I've lived a life of adventure. It's a good feeling to know I was able to carry out one of my dreams. And next up from the savor department, Konditor Rye in Kerry. Bavarian roots and North Carolina ingredients combine in these fine German pastries by Joel Haas. The solid granite facade of Anna Laura's German Bakery in Kerry promises old-world craft. Its logo exudes tradition, too, a shield for worldly protection, an angel for spiritual guidance, and a boulder for stability and longevity. Inside is a Konditorei, a Bavarian-style pastry and coffee house. Breads and sweets, all made daily by hand, fill the display cases, while tempting aromas waft from the 2,200-square-foot commercial kitchen. Here, hearty, wholesome breads are made with distinctly German ingredients. One example, the Brötchen, a roll with a crunchy crust and soft center, is a mainstay for sandwiches in Austria. My mother tried making these in the States after our family lived there for a few years in the 1960s, but the taste was never the same without the special flour. These are the real deal. I ate 5 in 2 hours. German natives Norbert and Anna Laura Gestattenbauer are both descendants of gastronomes. Anna Laura's family owns a brewery that dates back to the 1600s, that's where the logo came from, as well as a restaurant and bed and breakfast near Ulm in southern Germany. In Munich, Norbert's mother never allowed prepackaged food on her table. According to Norbert, it only took maybe 2 or 3 apple fritters to win his heart. He'd gone over to his classmate's apartment to study, and this classmate happened to be Anna Laura's older brother. She was busy cooking. It was proven again, the way to a man's heart is through his stomach, grins Norbert, and the two were soon a couple. They moved to New York for work 35 years ago, where they lived for 22 years. When friends started raving about the lifestyle in the Triangle, southern friendliness, warmer winters, and a lower cost of living, the couple came down to see for themselves. They fell in love with the area, but there was the practical matter of making a living. Anna Laura, who had worked as a private chef, wondered what she could make and sell here. She figured sweets are always a hit, and she was terrific at making pastries. They started their business with a 4-foot-long table at the State Farmers Market 12 years ago. Anna Laura baked at home until the wee hours of the morning, then Norbert would man the table at the farmers market. At first, business was slow. The breakthrough came almost by chance in 2009. When Anna Laura made something savory, authentic Bavarian pretzels. The couple announced the new product with a little sign. Suddenly, the crowds of passers-by realized that not only were the pretzels German, but so were the rest of the items, treats many had never seen or heard. Incredibly, we'd not thought to label what made Anna Laura's pastries different, says Norbert. Having long since become American citizens, we thought labeling our wares as foreign would turn customers away. Slowly but surely, business grew. Germans in the Triangle started asking Anna Laura to make Christmas Stollen, traditional German bread and cakes. The couple was working 12-hour days, 7 days a week. They engaged other pastry chefs, but soon it became clear that what they really needed was a commercial kitchen. When a rundown spot in downtown Cary went on the market, they snapped up the ideal location, tore down the building, and reopened their new place in 2017. All the equipment is German or Swiss, as are many of the pastry chefs they've hired. One advantage to all European equipment, it's set to metric measurements, like Ana Laura's recipes. Customers can see Ana Laura work in the kitchen as they stand at the cash register. This is a prime example of theater baking, says Norbert. We're showing the customer actual in-house production. One popular cake is the Prinzregenten Torte, Prince Regent's cake, which Ana Laura says isn't made anywhere else in the Triangle. It was created over 135 years ago by the King of Bavaria's royal baker on the day of his coronation. 7 layers of very thin, individually baked sponge cakes to represent the 7 districts of Bavaria, with chocolate buttercream in between. The whole cake is topped with apricot jam, enrobed with a semi-sweet chocolate ganache, and dotted with a single fleck of edible 24-karat gold leaf for each slice. Another signature confection, the bee sting cake, dates back to the Middle Ages. Legend holds that residents in a besieged city threw beehives over the walls to drive away an attacking army. To honor the bees, a thick layer of sponge cake is topped with an even thicker layer of buttercream. On top of another layer of sponge cake is added. Slivered almonds and honey are slathered on top before baking. The bee sting cake is so popular, we make it daily, says Ana Laura. While the Gestattenbauers source flour and other specialty ingredients from Germany, they use local honey, fruit, and nuts when seasonably available. They met many of their sources through that first table at the farmer's market. By knowing the producer, we can trust the purity and quality of the product, says Norbert. As we finished our interview, I asked Ana Laura what she likes to eat when she goes home. After a day of sweets, I like spicy and salty food, she laughed. Then she went back to making stacks of German bread fritters with fresh North Carolina apples. And from Endnote, we have Portrait in Pumpkin by Sarah Nagum. Kenny Krause can't draw. Put a canvas in front of him and he couldn't paint a masterpiece. He has no musical talent nor any skills in woodworking or clay. But every Halloween, 56-year-old Krause intricately carves a pumpkin so spectacular that he's become a bit of a celebrity around Raleigh's University Park neighborhood. He has one medium, and it's pumpkin, his wife Lee laughs. Each year, Krause picks a celebrity who died in the past 12 months and carves his or her portrait onto a pumpkin, painstakingly cutting and shaving the fruit skin to replicate facial features and hair. He's captured Elizabeth Taylor's piercing eyes and Andy Griffith's pleasant smile, Robin Williams' humor and angst, all in gored form. It started when Johnny Cash died in 2003. Krause had used patterns to carve simple Halloween designs into pumpkins with his daughters, now 18 and 20. So when he stumbled upon a pumpkin carving pattern of the famous singer online, he gave it a shot. I put the light in, and I'll be darned, it looked like Johnny Cash, Krause recalls. There was no turning back for Krause, who says he sells paper bags for a living as sales director for an international packaging company. He used patterns he found online for the next few years to carve the likes of Ray Charles and Johnny Carson. In 2007, he couldn't find a pattern of a celebrity who died, So he used computer software to generate his own design of Luciano Pavarotti to work from. So who will grace Krauss's pumpkin this year? It's a secret, as always. But as he does every year, he will create a pattern and go to the farmer's market to pick out a large pumpkin with a flattish surface for his art. The morning of Halloween, he'll set up shop in his sunroom, carving away for hours. Then, once it gets dark, he'll unveil his work, the only art he ever makes. And from happening now, Frida Kahlo, Mexican culture celebrated at North Carolina Museum of Art. The work of artistic icon Frida Kahlo will be on display at the North Carolina Museum of Art beginning October 26th. The exhibit, Frida Kahlo, Diego Rivera, and Mexican Modernism, is a highlighted curation from the renowned Jacques and Natasha Gelman collection. The Gelmans began collecting art after relocating to Mexico from Eastern Europe during World War II, says Jennifer Dossel, NCMA's curator of modern and contemporary art. The couple formed a close relationship with Frida Kahlo and husband Diego Rivera, commissioning pieces and collecting their work. The Gelmans also collected related art from prominent Mexican artists like Rufino Tamayo and David Alfaro Siqueiros. Dossel says the exhibit is fused with Mexicanidad, a concept coined in the early 20th century that captures a cultural movement whose goal was to define what it means to be Mexican. She says the art brings the personality of the community and its history. That goal was so general, it was reflected in so many styles shown in this exhibition. There's photography exploring indigenous people, abstract art, and, of course, Frida's very personal and symbolic paintings. There's a complexity to what Mexican art looks like. The art is on display at NCMA through January 19, just a glimpse into the collection amassed over decades, says Dossel. Even after the death of Jacques and Natasha, the collection is still growing, and the Gelmans set up their collection so it will grow in perpetuity. There will also be a showcase of reproduced garments inspired by Kahlo, who developed a very distinct sense of style and identity as she evolved as an artist. In the past decade, Frida Kahlo has become not only an artistic icon, but an icon of style as she formed her personal look, says Dossel. These garments, also provided by the Gelman Collection, are a really interesting way to expand on that idea and interest. We've run out of time for today's episode of Walter Magazine. Be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138.